And with our guest tonight, Marshall Klarfeld, as we talk about really what happened a long time ago on planet Earth. I'm going to get into the Egyptian pyramids with him in a minute and some of the fascinating finds in Peru on Coast to Coast AM. Marshall, has anybody tried to chart out this orbit of this planet, Nibiru? When does it come around again? If it, you know, yeah, every 3,600 years, it's got to be close again, huh?
Well, here's the way I looked at it, and I asked the same question to myself, George. You got to go back to an event when you knew it was here, and then add 3,600 years.
Exactly.
Cycles on it. All right, so if we know that the flood was like 12,500 years ago.
Okay.
And you subtract that, it was here in the inner circle, and when it went out, came back 3,600 years, and you subtract
3,600 from there. That's still minus 84, minus 4,800 years, minus 1,200 years, plus 20. Okay, so maybe it comes out the year 2,400 is when it comes back here.
Right. That's what.
That's my guess.
This is imprecise because we don't know exactly when the flood was.
You could be off by a couple thousand years, right?
You could, but I'll tell you, there's another way. I found there was a point in my research where there was a story in the Bible and also recorded in Peru in the Andes. They called it the day the earth stood still.
I heard of a movie like that.
Yeah. But the story, George, was that there was a battle going on in Canaan someplace, and the sun didn't set for 24 hours. And then on the other side of the world, the Peruvian, the sun didn't come up for 24 hours. So that the thing that I said, okay, well, if the Nibiru is in the vicinity and it can slow down the rotation of the earth, I don't know. You know, that's a possibility. There's a time frame, and there is a date of that war in Canaan, and I did that calculation once, and I came up with,
I would love, though, Marshall, while you're figuring this out, to have some scientist somewhere say, something strange happens to this planet every 3,600 years.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to hear that. I can't find them.
Well, let me go to a page in my book here. I think I have some quotes that I put in from some scientists that sent out a satellite.
Okay, I'd love to hear that.
To find it. They called it Planet X at that time.
Right.
And this was in like the 1980s.
There was also a big story in the newspaper during around that period with them saying that they had found the Planet
X.
Yes,
this is what I quote. I quoted that. I mean, it's a newspaper story. It was in the New York Times and the Washington Post. And wouldn't you know, I can't find it in my own book. Right
and now, and you know, the extra object that they found last year, Sedna, that's
yes.
not a planet. You know, that's probably some big asteroid.
Oh, by the way, I've come to the page that I think I should, for your listeners' edification, the Sumerians called it Nibiru, the planet of the crossing. The Babylonians recorded it as Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K,
mm-hmm.
king of heaven. Mesopotamians called it Marduk also, the great heavenly body. The Hebrews called it the winged globe. The Hindus called it Tetrayuga. The Egyptians called it the celestial disk. And the Greeks called it Nemesis. Now, interestingly enough, the Roman Empire lasted for 1,000 years. The Romans never saw it.
They never saw it.
No, never saw it because they never recorded it.
Right.
They only last, you know, a mere 1,000 years of history, and they never saw it.
What's fascinating is all these civilizations have seen something.
Yes.
Have witnessed something. They all call it something, but it is fascinating. Let's chat about, are you still looking for the scientist quotes?
No, I'm in the pyramids now.
Okay. The Egyptians, if you listen to the work of Zahi Hawass, who heads up Egyptians Antiquities.
Right.
He swears by the fact that the Egyptians made the pyramids.
Absolutely.
A lot of people say something else.
Vested interest in tourism.
Yes.
I mean, that's just where the hurry comes from. I'll tell you, I'll give you a couple of simple examples for your listeners. The foundation on which the three pyramids at Giza sit is a granite mountaintop that's been leveled to hold the weight of the stones. And the leveling is so precise that under 13-acre footprint of each pyramid, plus or minus a half inch, 13 acres.
Well, I know. How do you do that? I'm not even sure they could do that with modern-day work.
Yeah, but what the Egyptians had to work with were bronze and copper tools, who have a hardness on a scale of 1 to 10, diamond being a 10, of a 3.5. And granite is a 6.
So
there's no way.
There's no way they could chip away.
No way they could possibly. Now, point number two. There were tunnels under the pyramids that went down, shafts, 4-foot by 4-foot shafts, down through granite, 330 feet at a 26-degree angle. There's no way people with copper and bronze tools are going to cut a shaft.
And little chisels.
Right. Okay. Now, point number three, which is kind of interesting as far as we're concerned, there is on the middle pyramid at Giza, kind of like a snow-capped peak.
Yeah.
You remember seeing that?
Yeah.
Everybody can remember that. Okay, those are polished
the capstones.
Limestone casing stones.
Yes.
And you know why they don't fall down, George?
I don't know why.
They're glued. Those stones are 1/100th of an inch apart, and there's a mastic in between them that everybody has been able to analyze, but nobody's been able to replicate it, that holds the stones together. That's why they haven't fallen down. They're glued up there.
So they're not just placed there?
No. They would fall down. Gravity would, you know, plump.
And you're saying they don't know what the substance is?
They know what the chemical composition is, George, but we haven't been able to replicate it, and it's stronger than the stone. In other words, it's a... It's a glue that, you know, it's just so advanced that we can't deal with it. And the final thing I can tell you is just recently there have been some work done on the Sphinx, which was built supposedly at the same time as the pyramids. And they determined that the erosion they found on the Sphinx is water erosion.
Right.
And the last time it rained to produce that is 8,000 years ago. And guess what? There were no Egyptians 8,000 years ago.
Is it possible the Sphinx was eroded away not by rainfall, but by this flood, this tsunami?
No.
Okay, so that's not...
Well, if it was 12,000 years ago.
Right.
So anyway, this, you know, now there are quotes in my book on how the pyramids were built, who built them, and why they built them. These come from the cuneiform tablet translation.
Some people say that it's a power source. Do you believe that?
Yes, well, I'll just read you the, they need navigational beacons. So these casing stones that shone in the daylight were brilliant reflectors. They were like mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
So the twin peaks in Turkey, Mount Ararat, is two snow-capped peaks. Where the second set of twin peaks was required, mountains there were none. Artificial peaks thereon we can raise, so did the leaders say. On the tablet, the image of the smooth-sided, skyward-rising peaks for them he drew. If it can be done, let it be so. Enlil, he's the leader, with approval nodded. Let them also be beacons, serve. Now, here's where the power part comes in. By the Anunnaki, with their tools of power, were the stones cut and erected. Beside it, in a precise location, the peak that was the twin he placed. With galleries and chambers for pulsating crystals, he designed it. When this artful peak to the heavens rose, to place upon it a capstone, the leaders were invited. Of electrum, an admixture, Gibble fashion, was the apex stone made. The sunlight to the horizon is reflected. By night, like a pillar of fire it was. The power of all the crystals to the heaven in a beam it focused. They made lightning with what was inside in the crystals.
That's interesting.
Now, how? I don't know, but I know the Grand Gallery has 27 pairs of slots on either side of it, and there are story about them holding crystals in there, and the chamber, which they called the King's, had a pulsating crystal in that.
Which obviously they took out.
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know what the dimensions of the inside of that coffer is?
What?
Matches the Ark of the Covenant in the Bible.
Same thing.
Same dimensions.
Then there, as you know, there are no coincidences.
Well,
everything's planned.
I'm not saying that that's what it was, George. I'm just saying that that's a coincidence, right?
So you believe the pyramids were built as a navigational device?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They needed to find the landing platform. And the two reflecting sun-shining pyramids, sun-reflecting pyramids, were a line drawn between them and the twin mountain snow-capped peaks in Turkey.
And how'd they build them, Marshall?
With their power tools and with their chariot. Those stones were somehow...
levitated?
Well, let's say tractor beam.
Yeah.
You know, it's technology that we're talking about in Star Trek.
Right.
I mean, I don't say that's not possible.
Well, if it was created or built by alien technology, anything's possible.
Okay, now, if you want to talk about really construction, there's a couple of three stones in a place called Baalbek, Lebanon.
That's like a huge flat platform, isn't it?
That's a 5 million square foot landing platform, but in the northwest corner, there are three stones that are 64 feet long, 14 feet tall, 12 foot wide, and they weigh 1,200 tons each.
And what's their purpose?
Okay, when you launch, like in Canaveral, when we launch our spaceships, we have to push against something.
A gantry, right? Or
well,
you got your
concrete like mad on a pad underneath.
Okay.
And when the blast goes down, it's pushing against the earth, but it's not just the earth down there. It's a huge amount of concrete.
Sure.
So in this northwest corner must have been their launch corner, and these stones had to be taken from the quarry. Now imagine 1,200 tons.
This is one piece?
One piece. There's three of them. And they left one in the quarry to show what it looked like.
All right.
And then they lifted them up a hill, which is a half a mile away. And then they put them 36 feet in the air on top of some foundation stones and fitted them end to end perfectly without any mortar. And they still sit there today. And people have been, you know, just going bonkers trying to figure out how that was done. I don't think I know of any technology that we have, George. Could do it today.
Well, that's true.
Part of connecting the dots of these artifacts and sites in the book.
You think this area was a landing zone or an launching zone?
Yes, for
spaceships.
Take off and land, sure.
That region would have been right central to everything, right?
Yes. It's Baalbek, Lebanon is... northeast of the capital.
Could have been the extraterrestrial airport.
But here's
when
the Romans found it, George.
It's close to Beirut, right?
Yeah, right. When the Romans found it, they built the largest temple in the empire, in the Roman Empire, to their god Jupiter and their goddess Venus on top of this platform. I mean, it's 1,500 miles to Rome from this location. Why would they build such an enormous, the biggest temple ever built to Jupiter and to Venus was put on top of this platform. And that's why some people say, well, the Romans put those stones over there too.
And this platform, is it relatively smooth? I mean, does it look like it's constructed well?
Well, there's all kinds of things underneath it. In other words, it's the top of it smooth, but underneath it, there are chambers and passageways, and it's held by Hezbollah right now as a kind of a fort or training center. So most people that want to go there can't right now.
Were they able to see any rocket?
No. There have been no
stain or
physical pieces remaining. Except you have to kind of, you know, think outside the box and say, well, now if you were operating in an environment that didn't have infrastructure, didn't have navigational beacons, didn't have launching pads. You'd have to build something if you wanted to come and go as they did.
Why did they go eventually? Why'd they leave?
I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I could speculate, but it'd be mere speculation.
Well, tell me. We'll speculate for a moment. Why'd they go? I mean, that's always puzzled me. They came, and then they went.
Yes.
Why?
Well, my speculation, if that's what you want, George, I'll give it to you.
That's what I want.
They saw that they had launched us on pretty much a path of survival, that we weren't going to disappear. And if that was their destiny to do that, and they had maybe got enough of what they needed to fix their home planet, there was no real reason for them to stay here. That they phased off, and they created kingship. I don't know if you got into that or not, but the establishment of political rule by kings was something that they installed so that they would have a buffer between them and the people. And the kings, it's like kind of a clergy.
Were the Greek gods the Anunnaki?
Yeah. And my best guess is that if you trace the pantheon that existed in Sumeria, the 12 great Anunnaki leaders, and you take their characteristics. For instance, you take Enki and his brother Enlil.
It's like Zeus.
Zeus and Poseidon.
Yeah.
And then you take Jupiter and Neptune, because Enki was the water god.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
I mean, that parallel is just, it's kind of compelling.
And see, that just doesn't happen. It's got to be one and the same.
Well, okay, now ask yourself this, George. For 6,000 years, mankind kind of revered these 12 gods?
Yes.
I mean, that's longer than we've been doing our thing.
That's true.
And, the biggest statue of Zeus ever produced in the Greek Empire was a Homo sapien.
So you figure, now the Anunnaki, were they giants or were they,
Yes. Yes, they were bigger than, because the offspring, the stories of the intermarriage between the Anunnaki and female humans, they produced giants because they were bigger than we were.
Now, the evidence, Marshall, for all this stuff, is it out there for people?
Yes. Yes. What I've tried to do in Adam, the Missing Link, my book, is to picture it. I designed it kind of like Life magazine. There's not a lot of words in it, but there's a huge number of pictures which support the evidence of what I'm saying. I'm connecting the dots around the world of the things they left.
So when we come back, let's talk about Adam and Eve and who they were. I remember as a kid, I used to always wonder if they were space travelers that came down here.
No kidding.
Yeah, I always thought that. And it's very possible that as we get into your theory about Adam, the missing link, I probably came pretty close. I didn't hit it right on the top of the head, but I came pretty close, I think, in guessing of what Adam might have been or how it was created. And none of this, Marshall, really slaps the face of religion, does it?
No,
if anything,
no,
I think it enhances it.
It does. I mean, but people have to see that, George, because, we've gotten so fractionalized with our beliefs, and the inbreeding that goes on in each religion tends to generate a huge amount of animosity towards the other guys. And what we really need to do, and one of my hopes is that that people will understand that we all came from the same place. We were all created by the same race, species.
And because regardless of how we were created, someone had to create the Anunnaki, right?
Absolutely. Who created them on their planet.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a chain of things that go. And they, George, they talk very openly about their deity. They call it the creator of all. And I think their reference is the universe, that the creator of the universe is what they listen to.
Well, stay with us, Marshall. Let's talk about Adam when we come back. And your website, of course, is called adamthemissinglink.com. That's linked up with his name, as a matter of fact, on coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Going to continue chatting with Marshall. We'll open up the fast blasts in next hour. give you an opportunity to chat with him, too. This is fascinating stuff. I'll be back in a moment. Marshall, let me ask you a little bit about those Nazca lines in Peru and get your take on that. I think our old friend has written The Chariot of the Gods. Eric Von Doniggen has written about that as well.
Yes. Well, you know, starting from what Von Doniggen saw and what people have since tried to decipher, it's kind of like a big puzzle, George. It's there's so much material there. So I looked around and I focused on one aspect of it that I think is of significance to me, anyway, and I think it might be to the readers also, like on page 49. Carl Sagan, in his plaque that he put on Pioneer 10 and the records that he put on Voyager 1 and 2, drew a three-dimensional star map using 14 pulsars in the Milky Way to get the location of where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the left-hand side of that plaque. It's like lines, like a starburst lines. A lot of people look at it and don't understand it. I did a little research and educated myself. And I said, that's fascinating. Here's we're telling whoever finds this plaque out in space
this
where
is where it came from, right?
Yeah, right.
A roadmap. Not sure if that's a good idea, by the way.
No, I'm not sure it's a good idea either, George. But if you look on page 49 in my book, there is a bunch of lines on the Nazca plane that are very similar to this. In fact, I've reproduced it and show that the left-hand starburst is almost exactly the same configuration as the map that Sagan and his group put on.
Do you think Carl got it from these lines?
No.
Just,
I don't think he even knew about these
just
lines.
Happened.
Just that I think, because there's three of them, there's three sets of starbursts there, and it's in the configuration of the Orion constellation, the belt, the three stars in the belt of Orion. And the one on the left, I think, is their map of where they came from. That's my conclusion.
That's a good point.
And I think that it might one day work out to be valid. But there's, you know, there's monkeys with nine fingers, and
mm-hmm.
there's hands with nine this, and all this stuff. What I was also fascinated by, if you look at the drawings of these various animals and creatures, even the spider, it's like you never took the pencil off the paper.
Right. That you just kept going and going.
Kept going. And it was one continuous line. And I said, now, how was that done? Say you were on a platform, even a helicopter or something like that, up in the air, and you got a beam. And you've got to adjust for the rotation of the Earth and the platform itself so that you can reproduce this, because you're dusting away the top surface of the soil to make the line, and then to draw it perfectly smooth. These are really beautiful drawings. Quite a bit of technology went into creating those.
How come they've never eroded away, by the way?
The atmosphere is, I think these are at 10,000, 11,000 feet, and that was why that was chosen, I think, because it has longevity. And there's a bunch of stones that were buried in that sand that have drawings on them. They're called the Ica stones. I don't know if you got into that or not.
No, not yet.
But they show dinosaurs and men riding on dinosaurs' backs. Kind of interesting, because we know they didn't exist together. But they also show surgical procedures with amazing technology. You know, they had acupuncture needles for anesthetic. And they show a female donating her blood while she's pregnant to an operation of somebody else.
That's weird.
Well, here, let's think about this. The antibodies of a pregnant woman won't reject.
No.
And what was going on, by the way, in the other operation was a brain transplant. If you wanted, I mean, these stones are something else. I didn't put them in the book because I'm not sure about them, but it's a fascinating subject. Anyway, Nazca is, to me, evidence of an advanced technology, either doodling, one of the spiders there is a replication of an African spider.
Maybe doodling, or again, some kind of message or sign.
Message, yes, right. We haven't figured it out yet.
The crop formations, you really don't talk about that in the book, Adam,
no.
The Missing Link.
No.
We're going to talk about Adam in a moment.
I'm interested in it, George. I'm very interested in it, but frankly, I don't understand all of it.
It could be our modern-day Nazca lines, basically.
Yes. Well, there's one group that really fascinates me. If you look at the monkey's tail, is a series of circles continuously coming out from the center and going back. And I've seen crop circles that look just like this. And the other day I saw a scientific magazine that showed the formation of a solar system, and it drew a pattern just like this.
Let's talk about Adam for a moment, Marshall, while
okay.
We have some time this hour. He
sure.
was created by the Anunnaki. They needed a
yes.
worker. Was he the first of their creation?
The first successful, yeah. The first success that they had was, and they called him Adamu. And he says, Enki, the boy child, in his hands held the image of perfection he was. He slapped the newborn on his hind parts. The newborn uttered proper sounds. He handed the newborn to Nima. She held him up in her hands. My hands have made it. Victoriously, she shouted. Shaggy like the wild ones, he was not. Dark black his head hair was. Smooth was his skin. Smooth as the Anunnaki skin it was. Like dark red blood was its color. Like the clay of the Abzu was its hue. Now, of course, this happened in Africa. And I'm sure that the evolutionary Homo erectus had to be black, so that hue came over.
All right, so the Adamu is created.
Black.
What about yeah. Eve, the story of Eve now? How did that
okay.
pop up?
Well,
and then the serpent. I mean, what did that all have to do with this?
Well, you know, George, they did create a female because what was happening was the birth mothers, the Anunnaki birth mothers, really got kind of tired of producing all these primitive workers.
They thought they were like a baby factory or something.
Yeah, right, exactly. So what they decided was they'd create a female.
Let them do the work.
Let them do the work, right. And the female operation was very interesting in that they had four of them, two Anunnaki and two humans, and they took bone marrow out of the male's rib to create the female.
Much like the story.
Exactly.
Much like the story. That's a good point.
They couldn't fix, George, was that when you do cloning, you get like mules. They can't reproduce themselves. You know, it's like they're sterile.
Okay.
So they had to go and do another corrective procedure whereby the female could reproduce.
I see.
And that story, I think, is somehow intertwined with the Garden of Eden and the biblical story of Adam and Eve. And,
the apple, don't eat this, the fruit,
yeah,
the forbidden
kinda,
fruit and all that.
Right.
Somewhere along the line, where do they interject the thought of evil and things like that? Or are we going down the wrong
okay,
path?
Okay, that's a very good question, George. I've done a lot of thinking about that because I don't know whether by nature we're that way naturally or whether it comes from our genetic heritage.
Because it's obvious the Anunnaki were pretty violent in their own way.
Yes. Okay, so this is where you're tracking right along with me, George. I figured that the genes that we got were their genes. They were warlike people.
Yep.
They were their marital situations was like a soap opera. They were extremely sexual, and we got all those things. But the fact that they used us later on in their wars, you know, we were taught war to fight for their side
mm-hmm.
versus the other side. And, you know,
And look what's happened to us now. That's all we do is
right.
fight. I'm talking
right.
about as a planet. Of course, probably
exactly.
as us, too.
Exactly. Right. So that I think we just inherited what was there. And they survived. Apparently, they refer to some problems they had on Nibiru. I think they might have had an atomic war on Nibiru because it's one place they say, well, what happened on Nibiru will be mirrored here on Earth.
I'm not sure that there's anybody left on Nibiru.
Maybe not.
If that planet comes around, They may not be there to come back here.
Yeah, they might be a dead planet when it comes back. And you know, there's been Sitchin always talks about, well, you know, you got to worry about who's in control, whether it's the Enlil clan or it's the Enki clan, because these were the two opposing factions.
You know, we had talked earlier, Marshall, about propulsion. And, you know, my thought is that extraterrestrials from way outside, way beyond our solar system, have probably come through wormholes or something like that. But Nibiru was close to Earth and they came here and they come here whenever it is close, that tells me that they don't have that sophisticated propulsion system, or at least they didn't then.
Well, I think they talk about their chariots, and I, you know, there used to be water on Mars, and Mars was a way station. They used it as a way station. They had a colony there. And when the water went away, they said, you know, we can't use it anymore.
So did they.
It's uninhabitable. And they, I think they, don't quote me on this, George, but I think they use water as propulsion.
Hmm. Well, that's possible.
Yeah. But we don't know. You know, you got to put yourself in a mindset of us a million years from now.
Do you think this theory holds water?
Yes. I sincerely believe what I have put down on paper in pictures makes sense. There might be some little tweaking here and there, but from the evidence of the genetic engineering that was done, that they said they did, that we find in our bodies, that our human genome has 223 alien genes, and that we have this mathematical ability which we couldn't get off the planet without, had to come from outer space, that and the fact that in the short period of evolution of 250,000 years, we're walking on the moon. How's that happen?
I know. It is fascinating. But, of course, I think there are probably old artifacts on the moon from way gone back.
Sure. Well, I think we'd find one of the guys is buried on Mars. That's an interesting thing we'll come across one day when we go.
One of the Anunnaki?
Yeah, a leader. The guy who, I don't want to get into that story because he was the leader first. He's the first guy that came here, and then they wrestled for the leadership, Anu and he, and he did something very bad, and they
sent him out there?
They sent him out there, right, and he died there, and they buried him there.
Interesting. How'd you like to stumble across that?
Yeah,
maybe
right.
That's what the face of Cydonia is. Maybe he's buried under there.
They built a tomb for him. They could have built a tomb for him.
That's true. In your research, did you ever come across the alien greys or the reptoids or anything like that on this planet? The Egyptian mythology fascinates me because a lot of their statues have that, you know, reptoid look to it.
Yes, yes. I mean, there is even the Sumerians had that. George, the Sumerians have this guy holding the purse with kind of the alligator face and the human body.
I mean, to me, those were real creatures.
Yes, or they were symbolic of something.
Symbolic of something they saw?
Well, it was a mystery. Let's say that there are mysteries that I've encountered that I haven't got a clue. And I'm first to admit that I can't explain all of it. What I needed to do for myself was to verify, prove, connect the dots, and I did that. And now what my objective is to spread the word, to let people understand that this is one of the possibilities. You know, there's a big debate going on in schools right now, George, as to what to teach kids, either evolution or creationism or maybe genetic engineering.
Hey, do we think it's possible, Richard C. Hoagland and Tom Van Flandern were on my program on Monday as we talked about Deep Impact, that comet satellite?
Yes, I heard that. I heard that interview. It was very good.
Is it possible that what was between Mars and Jupiter, which is not the asteroid belt but perhaps a blown-up planet, might have been Nibiru? Is it possible that Nibiru has blown up?
No, I don't think so. I think what it is what... If you read Enuma Elish and take the translation and understand the mechanics, the celestial cosmology of it, we are the planet that got whacked. We were Tiamat. We were the fourth planet out, and when the moon of Nibiru whacked us in half. All that debris became the asteroid belt, and the Pacific Ocean is the evidence of where the hole was. And if you look at Pangaea, which is when the land mass was all on one side of the planet.
Right, it started splitting apart.
Splitting. Well, what was on the other side, George?
A big hole. A big hole caused when that chunk fell off the planet.
All right, so why are they moving? In other words, if it was balanced, and the Pacific Ocean, if you drained all the water out of there, you got a huge hole.
Where you could put the moon in, I guess, or parts of the asteroid belt, you're saying?
Yes, that's where the asteroid belt came from. Came from the debris of the. If you take the Mariana Trench out in the Pacific, it's 6.5 miles deep. Now, over the eons of time, the continental drift, these plates, tectonic plates, are moving to balance the Earth, to keep it centrifugally balanced. And they're filling up the ocean. They're pushing the Pacific Ocean into a smaller space.
They're shaping it. They're shaping it.
Yeah. So I wondered about that, and so I looked at Pangaea, and I looked at the Pacific Ocean today represents 33% of the Earth's surface.
That is fascinating.
And it's deep.
See, you've done a different kind of investigation than Zechariah has.
Yes.
I mean, you've taken this a little further.
Well, that's what goes on. I mean, the dialogue should continue. There will be people who take it beyond what I've done. I hope so. I hope somebody, but I think the ultimate goal, George, that we all need to do is to understand what really happened. And once we've made our peace with what really happened, we will at least maybe get rid of religious warfare. We don't need religious warfare. We've got enough other problems, economic problems.
Oh, I wish we could take care of it that way. Yeah. Do you think Stonehenge, by the way, was created by ETs?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, George, one of the things that might help is some humor.
All right, make me laugh.
I may come out with T-shirts that say, Allah was an astronaut.
Allah was an astronaut? I think you're the only one laughing on that one, Marshall.
Well, but, it may be true.
What's it going to look like? It's just going to be verbiage?
Just verbiage.
All right. Yeah,
no, and I'm just kidding, George. I mean, I wouldn't.
No, I know you're kidding, but you're serious about the T-shirts.
I'm serious about trying to get people to look more seriously at what they are considering is their faith and their belief. And why can't we all accept the fact that we were genetically engineered by an alien species, and let's accept it.
Are you ready for some phone calls?
Sure.
Okay, we'll do that. Top of the hour coming up. We'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Marshall Clayfeld right now. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.